From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Today on the show, three different takes on President Donald Trump's executive order on immigration.
The executive order is harmful, discriminatory, and unconstitutional.
That's Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey on the federal lawsuit she joined today against Trump's action. We'll also talk about the fallout from the president's firing of the acting U.S. Attorney General. A former Massachusetts U.S. attorney gives us her take on whom the Justice Department should be accountable to. And we'll talk to a Civil War historian who says the country's experiencing what she calls a shock event. Also today, WBUR's in-depth series, This Moment in Cancer.
I predict that in my lifetime, for those cancers that are now all too often lethal, we will be able to effectively control these diseases and increasing numbers cure them.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we will begin today with more pushback to President Donald Trump's executive order banning individuals from seven mostly Muslim countries from entering the United States, because today Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey joined the fight and says she'll file suit in federal court to get the order struck down.
The executive order is harmful, discriminatory, and unconstitutional. It discriminates on the basis of religion and national origin, denies our residents access to due process and equal protection of the law, and violates federal immigration law.
WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks was at Maura Healey's announcement today and joins us now in the studio. Hello, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna.
So first of all, what did the AG say was the goal of this lawsuit?
Well, first of all, it's worth noting that she's now the second state attorney general after the attorney general of Washington to challenge Trump's executive order in federal court. Healey says the goal is twofold. First and foremost, to get the order struck down, as we heard her say in that cut at the top of the show, on the basis that it's unconstitutional on a number of levels, according to Healey. That's the long-term goal. In the short term, it's to extend the stay on the order that was approved by two federal judges over the weekend, essentially to give it time to work its way through the court system. So extend the stay and strike it down.
I see. Okay, so about the argument that she's making that it's unconstitutional, tell us more about that. What did she say?
Well, she made the point that during his campaign, Donald Trump promised to ban all Muslims from entering the country. Now, the White House now says this executive order is not anti-Muslim. It's about making the country safe. The fact is the order focuses on seven mostly Muslim nations, and Trump wants to make exceptions for Christians fleeing persecution from those countries. So Healey says this violates the Second Amendment by discriminating against people of a particular religion. She also says the order violates the due process rights of Massachusetts citizens. And why Massachusetts citizens in particular? Don't forget, this legal challenge began over the weekend on behalf of two professors from UMass Dartmouth who are from Iran and who were detained as they tried to re-enter the country. So here's a bit more of what Healey said today.
But with a wave of a pen, the president's executive order kept them and thousands of others from coming home. The executive order barred people fleeing persecution and war. It barred Iraqi interpreters who have assisted our own military. And it barred students and researchers trying to get back to classrooms here in Boston and across this country.
So Meghna, Healey says that this executive order really strikes at the heart not only of Massachusetts' values, but its economic heart as well. So many immigrants and foreigners working in academia, in business, and it's why she was accompanied by university presidents, immigrant advocates, and business leaders, all of whom expressed support for this lawsuit.
Mm. Now, Healey called the executive order unconstitutional and harmful to Massachusetts, as you just said. But, you know, as it works its way through the court system, say she is successful in her suit, the results apply beyond the state?
Yes, absolutely. So this is a suit filed in federal court. Healey's effort here is to get the law struck down altogether. So if she's successful, if other attorneys general are successful, that's what would happen. The law would go away. And it's important to note that she's joining other legal efforts as well, including a lawsuit brought by the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. So here's Carol Rose, president of the ACLU of Massachusetts.
The ACLU told President Trump that if he tried to bring unconstitutional policies into our country, we would see him in court. Now that we have the power of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and the office of Attorney General Maura Healey behind us, I'm even more confident that this order will be struck down permanently.
Okay, that's, of course, the view of the ACLU of Massachusetts. A lot of big ifs there, of course, because it's got to be heard in a court of law. But Anthony, tell me, Governor Charlie Baker, obviously a Republican, he has said he's going to support Maura Healey's lawsuit, right?
Yeah, and this is significant. We've got a little bit of Governor Baker's statement here. He said, Massachusetts is a global community, and we all benefit from the shared experiences of our partners from around the world to support our economy and educational institutions to make our state the best place to live, work, and raise a family. The recent executive order puts that at risk and will not improve our security. And that's why he is supporting Maura Healey's suit. And it's significant, Meghna, because as you know, Governor Baker has really stopped short and really tried to avoid directly criticizing Donald Trump. He's been criticized for that. I think you can understand it practically. He's a Republican governor. He wants a chance at possibly working with the Trump administration. So he's tried to sort of hang back and let the other Democratic office holders really be more vocal in the criticism. But here he is today with a pretty forceful statement saying he stands by the Democratic Attorney General. So it's pretty significant.
That's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks bringing us up to speed on Attorney General Maura Healey's announcement today that she is filing suit in federal court against the executive orders issued by Donald Trump on immigration. Anthony, thank you so very much.
My pleasure, Meghna.
All right, so that's the latest on action Massachusetts plans to take in federal court. But let's jump to what's happening in the Department of Justice itself. Last night, President Donald Trump fired Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, saying she, quote, betrayed the DOJ when she wrote a letter to Justice Department lawyers saying that she is not convinced that Trump's executive order on immigration is lawful. Well, today, reporters asked White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer what Yates' dismissal indicates about Trump's relationship with the DOJ. Here's how Spicer responded.
That is a position of leadership that is given to somebody who is supposed to execute orders that are handed down to them properly, of which that executive order was 100% done. Ironically, it went through their offices, the Department of Justice Office of Legal Compliance. So the idea that it went through the entire process of which they were part of, and then she chooses not to execute it, actually is bewildering as well as defiant.
Well, that's the view from White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. But what is the actual duty of the Attorney General in moments where she or he disagrees with the president? AGs are appointed by the president, but whom do they ultimately serve? Joining us now with her perspective is former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Carmen Ortiz. She joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you just heard that tape from Sean Spicer saying that Sally Yates was behaving in a defiant way. Do you agree or disagree?
I wouldn't classify what her conduct and what she did in that fashion. I think that she was following her conscience. I think that as Attorney General, she has a constitutional duty to enforce as well as to defend the law. But in this case where she had directed department attorneys not to enforce this executive order, not to defend this banning, she indicated that her decision was based on two premises. One is that she did not think that the executive order was in line with what the department stands for, which is doing the right thing and seeking justice. And secondly, that she was not convinced that this executive order was legal. Mm-hmm. And perhaps give it time to play out.
So I'm curious, how usual is it for an attorney general or acting attorney general to make this kind of directive to lawyers in the DOJ, to go so far as to say, you know, if in your jurisdictions this comes up for a legal challenge, don't defend it?
It's unusual. It's a rare circumstance. I do recall that a position that the department had to take was to defend a statute that was negating certain rights to the gay and lesbian community under Attorney General Eric Holder. Mm-hmm. We defended that statute initially at the request of Congress, and as it was going through the appellate process, Attorney General Holder stepped back and told Congress and the Department of Lawyers, we're not going to defend this course of action, that it violates the equal protection of the individuals involved.
In that case, Attorney General Holder's view was very much in line with President Obama's.
That's
though,
correct.
Right? So here's the, this is the opposite case, though, where Sally Yates was, her opinion was obviously a polar, diametrically opposed from President Trump's opinion on the legality of his own executive order. Do you think that writing a letter, issuing a directive to DOJ lawyers was the right way to go? Or is it more usual in Washington for the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, to go to the president himself and say, you're going to face challenges on this. Here's how I advise you.
I think typically that's what would happen. There would be the discussion as to what this law is, what the executive order, quite frankly, and what policies it sets about, what the intended consequences, actual consequences may be, and so forth. But it seemed that everything happened here so quickly, and that the department, and I don't know what the specifics were in terms of the protocol and the process that was pursued, but it appears that a lot of folks that were responsible for implementing it were sort of caught off guard. Mm-hmm. And that's why you had the confusion and the situation over the weekend and so forth. But here, I think that, the Attorney General does serve at the pleasure of the president. And so he was within his own right to take that step if he...
To fire her,
to remove her, if he felt that she was not following in that respect. However, I will say this, that you cannot force an attorney general to do something that they think that is wrong and inappropriate. And in this case, quite frankly, when they fired her, when the president fired her and said that she had betrayed the department by refusing to enforce a legal order that was designed to protect the citizens of these United States, therein lies a tremendous amount of irony, because the way that this ban is actually taking effect, many experts, especially in the terrorism arena, would differ from that. Mm. That, in fact, the opposite happens when you have this kind of a broad ban that appears to target a particular group of people to restrict or violate their freedom of expression and religion. And quite frankly, that the effects, and I know because as U.S. attorney, we did a lot of outreach. We did a lot of work on preventing violent extremism. And so what you don't want to do is take steps that are going to alienate and further remove a group of individuals so they don't feel like they're part of the country and really being considered.
Yeah. So, I mean, Carmen Ortiz, you said so many interesting things there. First of all, you said the attorney general serves at the pleasure of the president. True. I mean, they're appointed. I mean, Sally Yates was appointed as deputy AG under the Obama administration, serving here in the interim while Jeff Sessions awaits a vote on his Senator Jeff Sessions awaits a vote on his nomination to attorney general. But so given that, though, ultimately, to whom, what person, what body is the Department of Justice accountable to? To the president? To the people? Whom?
It's accountable to the people in its way. And it has the duty to constitutionally follow the law. And so if an attorney general was forced to take actions that they did not want to take, obviously they could resign. They could refuse to do it and be subjected to ramifications by their boss. You have to understand that while traditionally, and there's a strive for a department to be independent from the president, the attorney general is also a cabinet member of the president, really, and selected to advise the president on legal matters and policy matters. But the White House has its own set of lawyers within its own institution in terms of the White House counsel to get certain advice and guidance as well. Mm-hmm. So the attorney general, at the end of the day, they're bound to follow the rule of law. And I think that based on the remarks that she made in terms of what the department stands for, questioning whether this executive order is actually legal or not or may not be, there was a basis for the decisions that she made. And let me say this, because I did work with Sally for so many years. She is a career prosecutor, very experienced, very dedicated.
She was a U.S. attorney for a long time in Georgia?
In Atlanta, Georgia. That's right, in the Northern District of Georgia. And she's been with the Department of Justice for almost three decades, since 1989. 1989. And I had the pleasure of working with her as we were both the U.S. attorneys and on the Attorney General's Advisory Council. I think she is someone of character, someone of real leadership, and someone who tries to do the right thing. And I think that's what occurred here.
So you think this is in line with the Sally Yates that you know?
Absolutely.
There are some people who are saying, though, that even with that she should have resigned instead, rather than taking the, as you know, we're discussing here, extraordinary step of issuing a directive to DOJ lawyers to not defend the president's executive order.
Well, you have to understand, and I don't know what the specific thinkings were. I haven't spoken to her or others involved in that inner situation, but things were happening very quickly. We just had lawsuits filed, and other lawsuits that I understand are being filed around the country, and department lawyers through the U.S. Attorney's offices have to go into court and defend those statutes. I'm sure the field was asking for guidance. How should we handle this, these matters? How should we respond? What legal arguments should we be making?
So, you know, Carmen Ortiz, in the past week or so, there's been a lot of discussion about sort of the internal mechanisms that various departments in the federal government have for hearing dissent within organizations. Like, you know, you've heard of the State Department's the dissent channel, where people can write letters saying they have a different opinion from the official one of the State Department. Just tell me briefly, in the Department of Justice, is there a way to communicate dissent within the DOJ that's not as public or jarring as what Sally Yates did?
Well, I think that, you talk to one another. And I'm sure that this decision that Sally made was not an easy one. And I'm sure that it was not one that was just primarily based on herself. It's like I've always indicated, I don't make decisions in a vacuum. You listen to those that are part of your leadership team. And sometimes everyone agrees. A lot of times they don't. You listen to various opinions, perspectives, recommendations, and suggestions. And then at the end of the day, as the leader, you are the one that, that you know, makes the decision. But I think that you definitely don't do it in a vacuum.
Two more quick questions for you, and I really appreciate your time here today. I was looking at some coverage from the New York Times, obviously, on this story, and they quoted Matthew Miller, a former spokesman for the DOJ during the Obama administration. He's concerned that Yates' firing could have troubling consequences within the DOJ. Matt Miller said, quote, "It's a major violation of the Justice Department's traditional independence that will send chills down the spine of everyone there." Is that an overreaction, or do you agree?
I think there could be some of that, for sure, because I think folks may have a great difficulty based on their experiences, based on their knowledge in terms of this particular executive order, and perhaps others that may come down in the future.
Now, Sally Yates said she is not convinced, in this letter that triggered her firing, this letter to DOJ attorneys, she said, quote, At present, I am not convinced that the defense of the executive order is consistent with these responsibilities, nor am I convinced that the executive order is lawful. And I'm going to put you on the spot here, little Carmen Ortiz, but do you agree with her? Do you think the president's executive orders are unlawful?
I think the way that it's being interpreted and actually carried out, where a particular group of individuals are being targeted, so that there's a degree they're being discriminated against in action as a result, as a consequence, and also that their freedom of religion and right to express religion may be violated. I think that it could be found unconstitutional. A court will decide that eventually, but I would have difficulty defending this executive order in the way that it is written. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be vetting individuals and be doing everything that we can to make sure that the folks that are coming here from overseas, from all countries, really are not a danger, that are not going to harm anyone in America. So I think that while the intent may be certainly legitimate to do everything we can to keep our country safe, how we accomplish that really has to be more well thought of. This is a broad brush, and quite frankly, it could create a greater degree of harm than good.
Well, Carmen Ortiz served as U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts from November 2009 to just January of this year. Carmen Ortiz, pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about something serious. No, it is serious. Let's talk about the weather, because a storm is moving across New England. And for a look now at how that could affect your commute home, we're joined in the studio by WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. Hello, David.
I know. What a surprise. I actually get to be here with you.
You're not in your bat cave of meteorology.
I am not in the bat cave.
All right. So what's the weather like? What should we see? What should we be concerned about for the commute?
Yeah. So one thing is, people probably heard a forecast this morning, depending on who they were listening to, hopefully here, of course. 3 to 5 inches was a common amount. And I think we're going to knock that back. I think we're going to back it off 1 to 2. Maybe 3, but I think 1 to 2 is going to be a good bet. So we'll go 1 to 3. Right now, there's some heavier snow down towards the South Shore. Rhode Island's got about 1.5 inches in the sort of northwest corner of Rhode Island. And then as you go back towards Connecticut, another 1 to 2 inches. But up here, it's just been some very light snow. And I think that that's going to be the case as we head through the evening hours. Yes, roads will become slippery. Yes, it could come down moderately for a little while, but we're not looking at a big storm here.
I see. So that sigh from me was, I mean, I'm happy for commuters, but I'm sighing for my kids who were so excited this morning when they heard that we were going to get snow. How long is this going to last? Is it going to last into tomorrow or taper off tonight?
Taper off tonight, but it's interesting. There's actually sort of two little bursts of snow. So this first one comes through this evening and ends maybe about 9 or 10 o'clock. Then there'll be a break for a couple of hours. There may be another burst late tonight that's where we could get another inch or so. And after that, it's done. So when you get up tomorrow morning, yeah, there could be a flake or two in the air, but basically the trend is partly sunny skies tomorrow. Temperatures tomorrow, not too bad, 35 to 40, so some of the snow will melt. Then we turn colder for the upcoming weekend, where temperatures only are around freezing. There may be another storm Sunday or Monday, but again, I'm not banking on that just yet. There's a lot of jury is out, and we could see absolutely nothing.
Oh, a little more uncertainty. That's exactly what we need. WBUR meteorologist David Epstein, so great to have you in the studio. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
This week on WBUR, we're featuring an exclusive series that takes an in-depth look at the remarkable excitement and energy going on right now in the world of cancer research in Boston. We're calling the series This Moment in Cancer. Here's former Vice President Joe Biden speaking in October of last year about his cancer moonshot and what makes now different from the last big push on cancer.
In 1971, President Nixon's interest and concern was real and genuine, but he had no army. He had no resources. No clear strategy existed to win. But 45 years later, after decades and decades of funding, new research, training scientists and physicians, treating millions of patients because of so many of you, we now have a powerful new technologies and tools. We have an army.
And so much of that incredible research, that research army, lives right here because it's happening here in Boston. One of those researchers has been working for more than 3 decades on the forefront of cancer. He's Tyler Jacks. He's the director of the Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research at MIT. He previously served as the chair of the National Cancer Advisory Board and as co-chair of the Obama administration's Cancer Moonshot Blue Ribbon Panel. And he joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Do you feel that excitement that Vice President Biden was talking about?
I most certainly do. I completely agree with everything he said. We're living through a remarkable time where we're translating this investment that we've made in cancer science to new treatments. And they're benefiting a large number of people, and they'll benefit many more in the years to come.
But so why? What's so different now? What's coming together that we haven't had come together in the decades people have been battling this disease?
I think it's important to put it into perspective. You know, he referenced the war on cancer in 1971. In 1971, we knew nothing about how cancers really arose. And in the time since then, thanks to the investment in research that enabled, we've learned a great deal. In 1971, we didn't know of a single cancer gene. Now we sequence cancer genomes at will. We know of hundreds of cancer genes, and we have developed new drugs that target many of those and thereby provide what we call precision medicines for cancer.
Hmm. So we have technologies coming together. We have different branches of the biomedical sciences coming together. We have this nexus here in Boston that seems perfectly set up for that. I want to explore that for a little bit more in just a moment. But Professor Jacks, it's still the second leading cause of death, right?
Yes.
The second leading killer in America, cancer is. Are we at risk of being too optimistic of the steps forward that we could take here right now?
We certainly do have to be realistic about where we stand. It is the case that cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in the U.S. In fact, in nearly half the states, it's the leading cause of death. And we have a ways to go. This year alone, 600,000 Americans will die from cancer. 8.2 people in the world will die from cancer.
8.2 million
people. And so we have a long way to go. But the progress that we've seen in the years, recent years, has been so dramatic in so many cases that I think we can safely project ahead that we have turned the corner, and those numbers will begin to come down, and eventually we will be in a position to control this disease much more effectively.
That's actually quite a bold statement to say that, in your words, safely say that we have turned a corner.
Yes.
You feel that confident about it.
I do, and I base it on, you know, real evidence. For certain cancers, take chronic myelogenous leukemia, which 15 years ago was a death sentence. And patients were treated with conventional chemotherapy, and 75% of them were dead 3 or 5 years later. Today, those same patients are treated with one of these targeted therapies, and virtually all of them survive with virtually no side effects, just as one example. Now,
that sounds like a miraculous
classic example, but it's not going to be the only example. There are many other drugs of that sort. There's new strategies to use the immune system to mobilize cells of the immune system against cancer, which are showing great effect in other diseases. So I think this is not wishful thinking. This is based on real, solid evidence in the clinic, which will make a huge impact in the years ahead.
So give us a little 101 on, say, how these targeted gene therapies work. For people who don't understand the technology, what's so different about it?
So cancer cells arise from normal cells because genes get altered. And you can equate some of those genes with the accelerator in your car getting stuck in the on position. The cells get stimulated to divide inappropriately. These targeted therapies reverse that effect. They block the accelerator from getting stuck. They remove that signal, and it causes the cells to stop dividing or, in some cases, to die. Now, importantly, there are many such genes. And so there's not a cure-all. There's not just one drug. You need to develop a suite of these things to target each individual alteration for an individual's cancer type.
So they're that specialized? They're that customized?
There are many, many cancer genes, and therefore there will be many, many targeted therapies. It's not to say that every last cancer has its own individual mutation or set of mutations. There are patterns and so forth. But we do need an arsenal of these drugs. Cancer is complex, and therefore there is not a one-size-fits-all solution.
Interesting. So when you say cancer is complex, that leads me to wonder, we've been discussing this in our office today, that it seems as if for some time now researchers have said that cancer isn't just one disease, but a variety of diseases.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I can make that more complicated for you, in fact. So, that typically refers to the fact that cancer is a set of diseases affecting many different tissues. It's lung cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer. But it's not just that, because there are many forms of lung cancer or breast cancer or prostate cancer. But it's not just that, because actually, as cancers develop in an individual patient, an individual cancer cell might be different, a little bit different, from the cell that's sitting right next to it.
Huh.
And so there's heterogeneity, we call it, which makes the problem that much harder.
Yeah. You know, I don't mean to be a negative Nelly. But I just want to return to this idea that are we at risk of being too optimistic? Because, for example, I remember, 15, 20 years ago when Dr. Judah Folkman was doing his groundbreaking research on angiogenesis and cancers and trying to figure out, you know, what if we attacked the circulatory system that feeds cancer? And it seemed for a long time he was making great progress.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of attention around that. I don't know where that research stands right now, but you know, we've seen those glimmers of hope before that somewhat faded away.
So let me contrast the current situation with then. Judah Folkman was a pioneering scientist and did very important work in that area. It did lead to the development of cancer drugs. They actually didn't work that well, but they were overhyped. The New York Times published that we would cure cancers in 2 to 3 years. This is a proclamation from Jim Watson, a Nobel Prize winner. That was overpromising. We didn't know enough to actually say that, and they were wrong. In this case, what I'm saying is based on data from patients in the clinic who are living longer thanks to these new treatments. Now, I do not want to suggest that tomorrow or next year or 5 years from now or 10, cancer will be a thing of history. It's not true. There's still a long way to go. My point is that the progress has been such in the recent years that it's safe to project that we will get there.
Hmm. Well, we talked about targeted gene therapies mm-hmm. for certain kind of cancers. This morning on WBUR's Morning Edition, listeners may have heard about the promise of another type of treatment, immunotherapies. Mm-hmm. And I would just want to play a small clip here from Richard Murphy. He's the 51-year-old father from Marshfield who was featured in the story this morning. Let's hear from him.
I hate the term game changer, but the immunotherapy, you know, saved my life. There's no doubt about it. You know, if it was 5 years earlier, I don't think I'd be here with this microphone in front of me. Maybe even 1 year earlier.
So a lot of excitement, as you talked about, around immunotherapy that's harnessing the immune system to fight cancers. Tell us a little bit more about that. But I've also heard there's some significant potential downsides
right.
to this one.
So I actually heard that report this morning as I was getting changed. So I think that, and I like the way he stated it, because it actually reflects the progress that we're making, this rapid progress that we're making. So immunotherapies broadly stimulate the immune system to recognize and eliminate your cancer cells as though they were foreign, like they eliminate bacteria or virally infected cells. Cancer cells are different from your normal cells. They're derived from normal cells that become different through this mutational process. We now know that if we can stimulate the immune system to see those cancers as foreign, to wake up the immune system, those cells can, in fact, recognize and eliminate the cancer cells. And there are many examples where this has worked. Former President Jimmy Carter is alive today because immunotherapy worked to cure his metastatic melanoma with metastasis to his brain. That was a death sentence not long ago. He is now cancer-free. And there are many other patients in that category. So these new immunotherapies work. The challenge is that if you stimulate your immune system, it might get overstimulated, and it might actually start causing harm to normal cells in your body. So we have to work a balance between attacking the cancer and not attacking yourself. And frankly speaking, we're still figuring out those rules.
Mm. What is it about Boston or the Boston area that seems to make the research, like this is such a locus of this cutting edge research on cancer right now?
Well, we have a tremendous number of cancer researchers, literally thousands of cancer research, and we have some of the best in the world. So the great institutions in Boston, MIT, Harvard, BU, BC, Tufts, they attract the best of researchers from around the world. They're well-resourced as well. And I think we take a very bold approach to the disease. We try to do transformative things here. I run a cancer center at MIT where we're trying to really push on the cutting edge of science and technology. So I think we push ourselves, we push each other. And because there are so many of us, we have the opportunity to interact and collaborate and work across institutions, and that gives us a distinctive advantage.
You've been doing this for, what, 30-something years?
Even longer, sadly, yes.
You don't look it. What first attracted you to the field of cancer research? And
yeah, I started as a college student, actually, and I didn't know that this is what I wanted to do, but I took a course from a professor who was interested in molecular biology. It was a new field at the time. He invited me to work in his lab. I got to do it firsthand at the bench, and I was really taken with it and the power of it. And then just a year later, I heard a professor from MIT, now one of my colleagues, Bob Weinberg, describe new research in his lab. This is 1982, describing the cloning of the first cancer gene, the very first one. And I thought, this is amazing. This is a breakthrough that will lead to not just a better understanding of cancer, but a way to approach it logically and scientifically. And I decided right then, actually, I think at the end of that class, that that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
In the decades that followed, did you ever feel a sense of frustration that we hadn't been making more progress?
Absolutely. It's a slow road. Cancer research, any type of biomedical research, takes time and takes patience and takes perseverance. And I and all of my colleagues have suffered through the trials and tribulations of failed experiments and observing the field as a whole and the fits and starts and blind alleys that we go down. But you have to keep going. And fortunately, with the collective effort of all of us in this community, we've made great progress. And now, for sure, it's paying off to the benefit of patients.
Given how common this disease or diseases is, has cancer touched your family?
Yes, absolutely. Many members have had cancer diagnoses. Many have died from those. I feel fortunate in my immediate family that that's not been true, but many members of my family and my community. So all of us are touched by this disease. It's all too common. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many of us care. Even if we have not had the experience personally, we've seen it. We've seen it affect families and friends. And frankly, we all feel an obligation to try to do more.
Well, it must be quite something to feel the wind in your sails.
It really does.
Well, Tyler Jacks is the director of the Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research at MIT. Professor Jacks, a true pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
And by the way, listeners, you can find a link to WBUR's special series. We're calling it This Moment in Cancer. All the stories are up right now. There's a link to it at our website, radioboston.org, and we will continue our special coverage on This Moment in Cancer throughout the rest of the week. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A shock event. That is what historian Heather Cox Richardson says we're experiencing right now with President Donald Trump's executive orders on immigration and the nationwide reaction that followed. She says that the country has experienced shock events before, say, in the run-up to the Civil War. Richardson is a professor of history at Boston College and author of many books on the Civil War and the GOP, including her latest, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. And she joins us now in the studio. Professor Richardson, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here.
So you wrote about a shock event in a post on Facebook. It's been liked or shared or whatever it does on Facebook more than 72,000 times now. Everyone's talking about it. What do you mean by a shock event?
Shock event is something that happens to a society that completely destabilizes the economy, culture, and America and politics. And when that happens, there are a couple of things that could come out of it. You could have a powerful individual consolidating power along traditional lines. If it's precipitated by an individual, they're usually trying to reinforce the fact they don't have a majority, and they step into the chaos created by a shock event to take power. Or it can be used by opponents of the people who were trying to consolidate power during a shock event to try and reconfigure what society should be, try to reorder what society should be. And it is not clear when one is going on which storyline is going to win out. But that makes it both a very frightening time and a time of enormous potential. And I think we're in one right now.
You do? Why? I mean, because granted, the president's executive order was a very powerful and potent one. The reaction to it has also been powerful and potent. But destabilizing is the word that you use in your definition of shock event that I question, because yeah, things are roiling right now, but I don't necessarily feel the democracy being destabilized.
Oh, I do. And I think not only the democracy, but things that go with it, the culture and to some degree the economy as well, although that's not as visible as it would have been during a destabilizing event like the crash of 1929. With the present moment, political parties are not responding to the vast majority of Americans right now. That's why we got the rise of Bernie Sanders and the rise of President Trump. You get a lot of people moving back and forth between political parties, or at least questioning their ideologies. And you see it today with the movement of people who previously affiliated with the Republican Party, people like David Brooks or David Frum, but many, many more people than that who are less visible, saying, we don't like where the country is right now. This is not a reflection of our values, and the government is no longer representing a majority of
but
us.
But isn't that fluidity the sign of a healthy democracy? I
mean, oh, yes.
You know I respect you and your scholarship tremendously, but I have to push back on this, because are you saying that our democracy is so fragile that an executive order of a 90-day ban on immigrants or visitors from seven countries destabilizes the United States?
Don't take me far enough to say it destabilizes the United States.
Okay.
It certainly has destabilized the political system. It has destabilized the political system that has held sway in America really since at least the 1980s, but really taking off in the 1990s. The division of America culturally, politically, and to some degree economically between Republicans and Democrats. And those lines became extraordinarily vitriolic and very powerful. And that political system that is arranged around these two political parties, where people almost treat them like sports teams, I think that has just been destabilized. That's what I mean by destabilization. The same things happened in the 1850s. And out of that came a much stronger America, not a much weaker one, but an entirely new political system. the same party names in some cases, but what those parties stood for and what those parties meant changed dramatically in that moment. And I think we're doing the exact same thing again.
So give us more of that historical context, right? Because when I hear the 1850s, the next thing I think is 1861 and the breakup of the Union. So.
Right. So that is not, of course, the future is not written, has not been written, which is why it's so interesting to look at the moment when it is being written. What happened in the 1850s was a situation that looks very similar to where the parties have been since in America in the last generation or generation and a half. And that is that, in that case, the Democrats, now the Republican Party, took control of their party and controlled the country to some degree. There's always caveats there. But in the case of the 1850s, the Democratic Party pretty much ran the country, and its actions were determined by slave owners, about 1% of the population. And they increasingly tried to spread their system of slavery and their system, their economic system, their cultural system, and the concept that the country really should be run by a few wealthy, educated white men across the entire country. So the South, of course, but also the New West, and eventually the idea was that it would become northern as well. That's a fairly complicated argument, but work with me on mm-hmm. that one. What happened then was that people who really hadn't cared much at all about what they were doing in the South and might have been willing to negotiate a bit over what was going to happen nationally with slavery looked at the fact that they wanted to spread to the West and said, wait a minute, regular guys, the vast majority of us, are not going to be able to make a living any longer. We're not going to be able to rise. This is America's about equality of opportunity. That's what we stand for. And there was a period of real instability when the parties, the major parties, the Whigs and the Democrats, and then splinter parties, the anti-immigrant Know-Nothing Party, the Temperance Party, the Free Soil Party, all sorts of things nobody's heard of any longer, jockey for some sort of power. But what emerges from that is when the slave owners went too far. In 1854, when they really tried to push slavery across the West, Abraham Lincoln and people like him, but he was the person really who articulated the vision, pulled together all those groups who had been so at each other's throats they had literally fought with guns into the new coalition of the Republican Party, which became the major and most powerful coalition in American history.
I do have to note the irony that, people were worried about America not rising because of the overreach of slavery. I mean, we had an encoded system to enslave people in the United States. But to your point of Abraham Lincoln pulling together these disparate factions. I mean, is part of your point in your Facebook post that is not what you're seeing now?
Oh, I'm saying we're not seeing it. We have not been seeing it for a long time. I mean, we could have written the history of the 1850s very differently if, in fact, that shock moment had happened or that shock event had happened and the Confederate leaders who railroaded the South, the Deep South, out of the Union so quickly had succeeded. We would be sitting here. Well, you and I wouldn't be sitting here today, but people would be writing the history of that being the moment that the new America, the new slaveholding entity, was born. That's not the thing that happened. What happened was, again, there was this other vision of what America could be, and most people liked that. Has that been happening in America until now? No. But since President Trump's inauguration, I have seen, because this is what I watch, a number of different coalitions coming together, different voices being heard, and being heard in a different way. So they are no longer protesting, for example, over some issue that is central only to their particular identity group, but rather to American values. Mm-hmm. This is not who we are. Who we are is a nation of laws. Who we are is a nation of principles. And this is what we stand for. And it's that on which Lincoln was able to build a coalition.
So let me bring in another president here as, again, respectful pushback. I'm wondering about the Jeffersonian ideal of that America needs a revolution every 50 years in order to reinvigorate those very core values you were talking about. And perhaps this is our half-century Jeffersonian revolution.
Well, I'm not a fan of Jefferson for a number of reasons. It's kind of a joke with my students. But you don't, I think, have to call it a revolution. I think that if it is a revolution, it is a conservative revolution. And I don't mean that in the political, today's American political sense of movement conservatives. I mean in the sense that the American Revolution itself was a conservative revolution based in law, based in the idea of equality, and based in principle. And when we have those revolutions, as we did, for example, in the 1930s with FDR, as we did in the 1890s and 1900s with Teddy Roosevelt, as we did with Grover Cleveland. I got to throw him out there because nobody knows who he is, but I miss poor Grover. But as we did with Lincoln as well, when we have those revolutions, America redefines itself in positive ways and ends up becoming once again both a principled and a prosperous country.
Mm. Again, I keep hearing the voices of supporters of Donald Trump who say that they believe that that is exactly what is happening right now. But to go back to your Facebook post where you wrote about shock events, you write that, "My point today is this. Unless you are the person setting it up, the shock event, it is in no one's interest to play the shock event game." Tell me more about that. What does that mean, the shock event game?
Okay, just so we establish this, shock event does not have to be created by humans. This one happens to
be. It could be a natural disaster.
It could be a natural disaster, right? Or any number of things. But the problem with a shock event is if you set up a shock event, if the politician sets up a shock event, what that person is doing is deliberately destabilizing everything. When that happens, if you can get people to divide along the lines they're already divided along, and as I say, somebody doesn't set this up unless they know they don't have a majority behind them, because if they did, they wouldn't need a shock event. You know, you've got the people on your side. Why would you need to do this? If you set it up, and if you can move quickly enough and exploit divisions that are already existing in society, so people kind of do the knee-jerk, oh, I know how to react to this, then they can take the country in a direction that many of the people who are their supporters didn't support in the first place, but they are already destabilized and they are already turning to their leader as the person who has the answer. That is the problem with that, is that if people simply take a look at the normal lines of doing business, either pro that or against that, they're being played. Somebody else has called the rules of the game.
So you see that happening now?
I did. Well, no. I mean, yes, I think that was the intent. I think this is not just the travel ban. I don't think that's all that was going on there. I think the extraordinary pace at which this administration has been throwing stuff, destabilizing stuff. You could have done any number of these things in very calm ways, and they deliberately, for example, didn't tell people on the ground how to implement the travel ban. If the fact that they are moving with this kind of extraordinary speed, I think, is an attempt to try and get people to say, oh, I hate all liberals, or oh, I hate all Trump supporters, so that when you get to the next stage, which is whatever the administration is planning, people are already so divided, they can't react to that as they otherwise would.
So what would a Lincoln-esque bringing together of disparate factions look like today?
Well, I think it looks very much like it did under Lincoln, under Teddy Roosevelt, or under FDR, or under Eisenhower. I think you say this, not what we are against. All Americans disagree on a number of things, and always have. We don't talk about what we are against. We talk about what we are for. And America fundamentally is a country of laws and of a place where people are equal before the laws. So you start by saying we need to protect this system and to make sure nobody, either at the very bottom or the very top, has a leg up over everybody else. The same rules that apply to you apply to me. And that in a democracy, and I know somebody's going to say we're not a democracy, we're a republic, but in a place in which everybody who is part of the society is supposed to have a say, we guarantee that people do have a say. And that protects people not just in this case, the Democratic Party. It also will protect people in the Republican Party, because the more you limit the electorate, the more you let the people in power get more and more extreme. And when there's a backlash against them, it is a tsunami, which is what happened with the progressive era. So you say, first of all, we believe in the laws. Second of all, we believe in people's right to have a say in their government. And then that we protect our principles, that we believe in equality. We believe in prosperity. We believe in hard work and people working their way up. And you strip it back to where we all share the same values and work from there.
Heather Cox Richardson, you're a deep scholar of American political history. You are more used to spending months, if not years, uncovering these stories and analyses through your scholarship and your books. I'm curious why you posted this on Facebook, because you started your Facebook post. Again, it's been shared more than 70,000 times now. You said, "I don't like to talk about politics on Facebook. Political history is my job, after all, and you are my friends, but there's an important nonpartisan point to make today." Why did you put this? We've got 30 seconds left. Why'd you put this out on social media?
It was my personal Facebook page because I saw so many people reacting along regular lines for the travel ban. I do talk about politics in my professional life, for sure. It's what I do. But for my friends, I don't talk politics over dinner or anywhere else. And I was just trying to say to them, there is hope here.
You've got more than 70,000 new friends now, I guess. Heather Cox Richardson, she's a professor of history at Boston College. She's author of a recent Facebook post. We've got a link to it at radioboston.org. And she's also written many books, including To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Professor Richardson, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.